This is Embodied on the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. The Americans with Disabilities Act turns 30 this year, but discrimination against the 1 in 4 people with disabilities in the U.S. continues today. Ableism shows up in more than just the workplace and grocery store. Widespread ignorance about disabilities turns hookups, dating, and relationships into a test of patience, and sometimes a very real danger. Today on the Embodied series, we are talking about sex and dating with physical disabilities in particular. And pay close attention, because there are some good lessons for able-bodied folks to learn about how to improve relationships and pleasure through assertive communication, skills polished by wheelchair users. I'd like to welcome our first guest to the program now. D.R.C. Charrington is an advocate and a doctoral candidate in English at The Ohio State University, and he is from Cary. Welcome, D.R.C.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Happy to have you. I would love to start by learning about your upbringing in North Carolina and maybe a bit about how your family and community's expectations shaped your own notions of what was possible for you romantically and sexually as someone with a physical disability.
Sure. So I have spastic diplegic cerebral palsy. I was diagnosed when I was 2, and we moved to North Carolina when I was 8. And so basically, as I was growing up, on top of being African-American and disabled, I am also queer. So as a gay man, it was really frustrating, mainly because, you know, in Cary and in high school, you would see, like, some of the gay kids at the high school who were flashy and flamboyant, and, you know, people would be, like, low-key making out in the dark or whatever, and you know, you like want to ask those questions, but, you know, at 16, people don't even have the wherewithal or, you know, kind of the idea that you are a sexualized person. Mm. So as a teenager, I was very depressed, mainly because I never saw a Black disabled person who was also gay anywhere. No media, no TV, no books. You know, I saw gay people occasionally. Queer as Folk was my very first show I'd ever saw, and I was literally sneaking around to watch it in the dead of night at 11:30 because I didn't want my parents to catch me. But, like, it was the only place, and, you know, they are abysmal with people of color on that show, and disability never comes in at all. So, unfortunately, that led to me putting myself in spaces that I really probably shouldn't have been in. But the reality was, you know, I was on, you know, out.com and gay chat rooms just trying to go on dates. I just wanted to go to lunch with, you know, some nice guys. And I met a professor from Duke who told me he wanted to go to lunch. And, you know, that afternoon, unfortunately, turned into a sexual assault. Mm. And as a disabled person, you know, basically it was like he took full advantage of the fact that I couldn't walk. And, you know, then on top of that, he was just like, you know, you should be grateful that, you know, I even chose to give you the time of day. And so it wasn't a great way to begin my gay life.
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, and you mentioned so much in there that I want to pick apart a little bit, one of which is, I mean, really early on kind of mentioning that there were these multiple communities that you were a part of in high school. There is, like, the gay community, and you're a part of that, and seeing what gay kids in your high school are doing, you're trying to kind of find your own space within that, but you have very little representation of other Black queer folks. So, I mean, have you felt accepted by the various communities that you're a part of, or has your disability impacted the way that people kind of embrace you in these various communities?
Yeah, like, if you're queer, like, you can be Black, like, that's fine, and I would argue that, you know, the gay community actually really enjoys that, but only a particular kind of Black. And so then you get into the fetishism side of race, but disability literally isn't there at all, like zero. It's almost like you don't exist. And most of the time, you know, when I'm talking to other gay people and, you know, it's like, it's so frustrating because people talk to me and they're like, oh, you're so witty and charismatic. Oh, and you look nice and you have a nice face and a nice body. And then you mention that you're a wheelchair user. 90% of the time, people will just log off or they just disappear. And it's frustrating because it's not like you haven't had a great conversation for 2 hours beforehand.
Well,
so
what
it's
is
like,
that?
You know, I'm the same person.
Right. And I mean, tell me about kind of navigating that rejection. I mean, in the online world, it's a little bit different than in real life, I'm guessing.
Right.
But I mean, how do you navigate that for yourself? Because that seems so hurtful.
It is very hurtful. When I was younger, like I said, that's what unfortunately led to me meeting with the professor, because, you know, you deal with the rejection constantly, multiplied multiple times over. But, you know, as I've gotten older, that has become, it's like more of an understanding that, you know, these are people that I wouldn't want to deal with anyway. And so that's basically what I tell myself. It's that, you know, if you have a problem with this now, you know, I'm giving you my cards up front. And, you know, if you don't want to deal with it, that's fine. You know, if anything, I just save myself months and months and months, or possibly years, of shallow heartbreak that able-bodied people are going to find out at a later date, and I feel really sorry for them. So that's basically how I spin it. You know, it's like, you know, you kind of have to put it in your mind that this is not, I mean, I think that's the one thing I would tell anybody, is that it's not your problem, it's their problem. And, you know, that's what ableism is. It's like, you know, I was born with this disability. It's society that has the problem with disability. It's not my problem to go back and tell somebody to fix.
I want to bring in one more guest to the conversation now. This is Julianne Scott Pollock. She's a professor in communication studies and the director of performance studies at UNC Wilmington. Julianne, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So one thing that DRC mentioned in his experience of high school was kind of this notion that people didn't see him as a sexual person. And I want to talk with you a little bit about that. You talked about that with us when you were on our show way back when, of kind of how people view sexuality when it comes to folks with physical disabilities. So could you talk a bit about kind of some of the mythology and misconceptions around the sexuality of folks with physical disabilities?
Well, for me, so many ways as we hit puberty and our bodies change, we all go through this sort of re-understanding of our bodies. But for me, I had a dramatic operation that took 2 years recovering, starting from 11 to 13. And I started high school a year early at 13. And suddenly, with spastic cerebral palsy that used to have my back hunched and my knees and my feet facing each other and up on my toes in a way that was obviously read by other people as disabled, in ways that I would get looks of pity, looks of discomfort, and in so many ways just sort of erased from that idea of ever being attractive or being cute or all the things we call little girls growing up. And then suddenly at 13, with my back straight and my feet facing forward, even though I still had an obvious limp, people read it as a temporary injury. And so suddenly, my body, which had been in physical therapy since I was 2 when I was diagnosed with cerebral palsy and had very defined muscular structure, was read as athletic and temporarily injured. And so the amount of attention that was suddenly coming at me was a little bit overwhelming from people. I remember the first time walking into high school as a 13-year-old girl, and there was a group of boys standing in the corner nudging each other and laughing, and I thought they were making fun of my limp, and I didn't know what to do. I was new at this high school, and finally one of them came over, and I was so braced for something really hurtful, and he asked me if he could show me where my class was. He could tell I was new here. And so suddenly I became this sexual being that people would flirt with from time to time. And it was almost jarring for me to suddenly have to re-understand that my body was passing at for moments, even though I had this obvious limp. And the look of just sadness boys would get when they found out that it wasn't temporary. That this actually was a physical disability, which then jumped to, oh my gosh, well, how much time do you have left? And it's like, I'm not going to die. It's a condition. It's not progressive. And so this idea of having to continually navigate that, and I would say I still navigate that now, of that of, oh, did something happen? Oh, you're disabled. That's so sad. Oh, but you're not going to die, so maybe it's not. And so that's sort of having those conversations over and over again throughout my life as a disabled person that people sometimes misread.
Yeah, I mean, DRC, talk about that. I mean, you spoke about your first experience, which was very traumatic. Moving from that, I mean, did you find ways to negotiate and build language around having conversations in relationships about your abilities and how people could support you or how you could navigate that within the context of a relationship?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was funny just listening to her story. I was thinking, so the assault happened in February, and in March of that same year, I left and flew to Germany for a study abroad in Europe for 7 months. And while I was there, that completely changed my entire outlook on my entire life, because on the plane, on the way over, you know, the flight attendant was just like, so what are you doing when we land? And like, this was a man, he was, you know, really attractive flight attendant for Lufthansa. And, you know, I'm 19, you know, I haven't really gone on a date, don't really know anything. And he was just like, you know, do you want to go out when we land? And I was just like, I was going to go to bed. And he was so disappointed. But it was like, from the moment I got there, the conversation immediately became about race, and the people in Germany are infatuated with like Black culture. And that translated onto me as like all these men being like, oh yeah, like we've never had this opportunity. And like, here it is, you know, it's not exactly in the package that we would have thought, but you know, we don't care. And like, this is why I think that, you know, ableism will change depending on the circumstance and the society in which you live in. Because in Europe, I was constantly, I opened a profile like a week after I got there, and a friend helped me set it up on like a dating site. And I legitimately had around 30 to 40 individual requests every day, all day, hundreds of people that were trying to like pour into my inbox because they just wanted to like go out. And it made me feel so much better about my life, and also about the fact that the United States just doesn't know how to deal with people, partially because our culture is so repressive that it's like we don't really know how to deal with people that are different from what we expect. But, you know, Europe, because it's the melting pot of the planet, I just feel like the people over there have a much broader understanding of different kinds of people. So it really wasn't that big a concern. And I dated another flight attendant for like 6 months, and he was wonderful.
Hmm. Well, I mean, that's so interesting that, like, yeah, parts of our identity become more or less salient to people around us based on kind of where we are culturally, as well as the phase we are in our life. And kind of reflecting on Julianne's story, I mean, the way that people perceived you was so different from maybe how your own narrative of yourself was changing as your abilities were changing. So as you've kind of continued to grow and navigate that throughout the course of your life, I mean, what have you learned about kind of how you wish people communicated with you about your physical disability, and how much of a part of the conversation you want that to be in a given moment?
So at this point, you know, I am much more direct and forward about, you know, the kind of people. I recognize that it's a continuous problem within the queer community at large. But I also think that, you know, it's like you run the risk of finding people who find it fascinating. And I have been in a couple of unfortunate situations, you know, with people like devotees, people who find disability sexually attractive. And it's weird because when I talk to other people with cerebral palsy and, you know, in disability groups about it, there are some people who haven't had the privilege to be in a social situation, to be, you know, kind of exposed to that. So they were perfectly fine with the idea of devotees, like, talking to them, because it's like the first time in their life that they're actually getting attention. And, you know, trying to explain that it may not be the right kind of attention is very difficult for people who, you know, it reminds me of a quote on Facebook. It's like, if you've never had love on silver spoons, then you learn to lick it off a knife.
Mm.
And I feel like that quote is so apt in so many different ways, because it really applies to the way that able-bodied people treat disabled people writ large, in relation to relationships. But, you know, these days, I'm happy to keep a drawer of knives And, you know, if people are not satisfied with that and, you know, they wanted a butter knife and I'm coming with a serrated edge, then they just need to they can either get with the program or leave. And, you know, I recognize that, you know, that puts me in a situation where it's like, okay, well, maybe you're going to be single for a really long time. Maybe. But then again, I'm also not in relationships waiting on one of the partners to suddenly develop a limp or suddenly develop some kind of disfiguring condition that the other person doesn't really want to tell you about. And then they just leave you in the middle of the night, because I've seen and read about that repeatedly during the COVID pandemic. Via the New York Times and other places. So, you know, it's just one of those things. Like, you have to, you either come with the all of your cards on the table up front or you don't.
Well, Julianne, I want to talk about kind of beyond the person that you're in a relationship with. There's also negotiation with families and kind of pressures around, pressures that people face who are in relationships with people of varying disabilities that they get from those in their lives. So can you talk a bit about how that has factored into your own experiences as you have dated over the years?
Oh, sure. I remember one of my first boyfriends, and I would say this happened several times, his mother was really negative towards me. Her body language was just hostile. And I'm a communication person, and at first I was thinking, well, you know, maybe I'm overthinking this, you know, but it got to be after a couple of months, I'm like, she really does not like me. And so I finally asked him, I said, what is going on? And he said, well, you know, I'm the oldest boy in this family, and she's just really upset that I seem to be getting serious with someone who can't have children naturally. And I said, and I was like, well, who are you getting serious with? You're dating me. Like, what's going on? And he's like, well, you know, with you having cerebral palsy. And I realized we had never had the conversation that cerebral palsy in no way, shape, or form impacts my fertility. I've had 4 children conceived and given birth naturally. And I realized that there was just this idea that his parents had, and that he had confirmed himself just assuming that based on this diagnosis that I could not have children. And I think that, and that explained, and that made sense to me how he sort of would talk about sometimes about like, well, you know, we won't really need a lot of birth control and these kinds of things. And I always kind of wondered, like, what are you talking about? Like, of course we'll need birth control. And I realized at that point that he just assumed that I was unable to get pregnant because I'm disabled, when that is in no way part of my diagnosis or challenges in life in any way. So I think there are ideas of how people, that even if someone is attracted to me, and it's not that I haven't had people attracted to me, and I think sometimes even attracted to the disability and that idea, oh, you're small and you limp, I just want to carry you and take care of you, which can be very problematic in a lot of different ways. Also that idea of, like, even though you're sexual and I'm sexually attracted to you, there must be part of you that's broken in this way. And so where that question, there's many people that do not have visible disabilities or any disability at all that do struggle with fertility. And no one ever assumes that, like they automatically assume it with me when that is actually not a struggle I have at all.
I want to pause right there. We're going to take a quick break and come back and talk more about communication and how we can communicate better about these things, and maybe educate ourselves better about all of these things to have more clarity and better conversations. Julianne Scott-Pollock and DRC Charrington are both going to stay with us as we continue our conversation on Embodied, on the state of things just ahead. Please stay with us. This is Embodied on the State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. Going on the apps and online dating is a preferred option for many folks these days. But for people with disabilities, a Grindr or Hinge profile can be a bit more stressful than for able-bodied folks. Is it better to show the wheelchair and profile pictures, or maybe just mention it after matching? The stress of disclosure and the impending questions to follow can make dating incredibly tiring. I am here with DRC Charrington, a doctoral candidate in English at The Ohio State University, as well as Julianne Scott-Pollock, a professor at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. Also with us now is Ariella Barker. She's an attorney for the City of New York and former Miss Wheelchair North Carolina. Ariella, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So we've been talking about communication and how to communicate in various stages of the relationships. And I'd love to know for you, what are the kinds of conversations that you want to have about your physical disability early on a first date, if any at all?
When I was younger, I wanted to avoid the conversation altogether. I didn't want to talk about my disability. I felt like that was pointing out my defect because that's the way the others looked at it. And so I felt like if I brought it up and made it a subject of conversation, then it would make the other person feel as though it was a bigger issue than it was. And that also came into play with internet dating. You know, I felt as though if my profile picture showed my wheelchair, well, then that would immediately turn them off. They wouldn't want to date me. Should I include it in the profile? Because I didn't necessarily feel as though it defined me. But later on, as I had one horrible experience after the next, or one traumatizing experience after the next, I realized that I wanted to have that conversation as soon as possible for nothing other than to weed out potential heartbreak, and also to better prepare that person for what lies ahead, including what judgment or bad advice they might receive from others whenever we could potentially become serious, including their mothers, because mothers always hate me. And for similar reasons, as discussed before, primarily, you know, this assumption that I couldn't have children.
Well, yeah.
So the conversations were always, I always found it best to bring it up as soon as possible.
And Julianne, I know, I mean, there are so many assumptions that can be made both early on, but as well as even kind of once you are in a relationship based on how people experience the way that your body moves or reacts to them. And when you're in relationship with folks, you have to navigate that in a very particular way. I know that you experienced that with kind of physical communication being misread in relationships because of your disability.
Yes, that would happen on a regular basis because I have a spastic cerebral palsy, which means my body tenses on its own without me meaning to tense. So while that is a nonverbal communication of stop, you're making me uncomfortable, for partners who would know my body, they would just assume, oh, that's nothing to pay attention to. She has cerebral palsy. That's just happening. So even a very attentive partner who cares about me and my comfort level, I would have to physically say, I'm really uncomfortable. You need to stop. That's hurting. That's why I'm tense. Please don't do that. So I feel like I've had to learn to be very verbal when it comes to intimacy with partners. And I think in a lot of ways, though, as I teach college students and we talk about, I teach a first-year student seminar where we talk about consent in different points, and I realize that what I've learned to do because I have an atypical body is something that all partners would be safer if they just would do. And so that idea of not counting on people to read your signals and telling them and being assertive of what is and is not okay. So I think in that way, having an atypical body gave me that level of having to be more assertive because I knew that people continually misread me.
Right. I mean, and conversations around consent and assertiveness are not something that we're very practiced at having. Definitely not something that I learned in my own sex ed experience growing up. And I wonder for you, DRC, I mean, how did you learn to best communicate about your needs and wants verbally? Was that something that came naturally to you, something that you learned, or something that you had to figure out?
Well, to echo what was said earlier, it's interesting because, you know, for as much as you want to tell partners, you know, that you're uncomfortable and, you know, not to do certain things, I've had it be just the opposite as well. Like I remember in a couple of situations where, you know, I was dealing with someone who actually was going overboard in his care, and he was treating me like glass. And, you know, I basically was like, you know, you need to realize that I was disabled before I met you.
Mm.
I will be disabled after you leave. And, you know, like, basically, if something is going wrong, like, I will let you know. But if I don't ever say that to you, then just assume that this is business as usual. And, you know, I think that it plays into the idea that, like, people want to be kind. But then you get into, you know, like the very gray area where intimacy can go overboard and turn into infantilism. And so, you know, it's like if you do it that way, you know, that's not desirable either. So, yeah, I had a series of when I used to live in London, had a series of dates where it was like, you know, I would be inviting guys over and, you know, things would just, you know, they were doing things that they thought were appropriate. And, you know, I would be in my head, like, you know, this is not working. And, you know, if we could just talk about this, it would be much easier. And so, yeah, eventually, you know, I turned 27 and I basically was like, you know what? I'm not doing this anymore. I'm too old. I'm too old for this. And, you know, this is a lot of it is, I feel like what happens to people when they're younger than me, you know, because I never got the dating phase the way I deserved in my teenage years, you know, it was delayed. So I felt like I was doing what teenagers would do in my mid-20s because everything was delayed. And so, you know, it took me a little longer than it probably would take an able-bodied person to just kind of get over all of that and to just be very forward and, you know, direct with the kind of things that I like. And, you know, that includes sexual practices, that includes a list of, you know, do's and don'ts. You know, again, I think it's hilarious that people assume that we're not sexual beings. And the reality is, you know, it's like, I like to do lots of things, but you have to explain that to people because otherwise they just assume that you do nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody could benefit from that.
I'm curious about that for you, Ariel. I mean, what does it look like when a partner has navigated your access needs really well? Like, what has it looked like when someone has done something in a way that felt really good and affirming?
I'm trying to think if I've had one of those experiences. Mm-hmm. I think that probably the only time that I've ever had experiences like that are where I've dated, I've been friends with the person previously, so they already know the drill and they already understand it. And so it's refreshing, but I don't think that I've ever dated anyone who instinctually understood any of those issues, including access. You know, mainly it's because if people have never been exposed to that, how would they even think to wonder if the bathroom in the restaurant is accessible, or even so much as to think how would I pick her up in my car and take her there? You know, a lot of people just think that you could throw any old chair in any old car and go wherever. So a lot of people just don't have the knowledge and understanding to know how to, you know, instinctually do things that way. And I would never have an expectation of it starting off that way anyway. I always assume that education has to come initially in the beginning.
You've written a lot about your own experience in the dating world and otherwise, and have written about experiences of sexual assault, which you alluded to a little bit earlier, and how they've affected your relationship with your body and with potential significant others. And I'd be curious to know, you know, how have those experiences kind of shaped your feelings of vulnerability in your body, and where are you with that now?
Yeah, so again, listening to ERC's story really honestly made me tear up. Because I recognized that so many of us, 80% of women with disabilities, are sexually assaulted in our lifetimes. And it's because I think, you know, we have the intersection of gender discrimination that becomes violent, as well as, you know, ableism, because we're so vulnerable, and that combination creates an incredibly dangerous situation. And after first experiencing it, and for me, that first experience was actually a best friend, so that made it even more impactful. And after experiencing that, and I found that I did this not just with sexual assault, but with all bad or traumatic experiences in my life, is that I would analyze the situations in retrospect and decide what it was that I did wrong, or what it was that I could do better in the future to prevent those things from happening. And so I systematically created a system with so many rules in place for my own dating life to protect my safety, to protect my heart, that I ultimately became in a situation where I had so severely limited the amount of people that I could date, or the forms of dating that I would accept, or the types of dates that I would do, or the situations that I would put myself in, that I ultimately erased all possibility of dating for myself, because essentially, I ultimately had to remove every single category of men or situation out there. And in time, and I think the culminating event that kind of made me realize this was after dating someone who had been a very close friend of mine previously, and we become serious and we started talking about marriage, and then he immediately got very distant and ultimately ended things with me, saying that my disability was too much and he wasn't strong enough. And after that, I was so devastating, because that was the very representation of all my worst fears made true. Now I realize that this was, you know, what other my partners were thinking. And I realized that all of these restrictions that I made on myself, all the way up to the realization that I needed to only date people that I already had an existing established relationship with, so that I could trust them and know that they were already comfortable and familiar with my disability, I realized that, well, now that's not even possible. And I realized that it wasn't about me, and it wasn't about my decisions, and it wasn't about the situations that I was putting myself in. It was about them. It wasn't about me at all. And his statement that I'm not strong enough, that completely answered everything for me. In my mind, my entire life, it was that I was not physically strong enough, and that disability made me defective to others. But what I realized is that those people were not strong enough mentally, emotionally, whatever it was, to deal with any challenge whatsoever in life. Maybe it was disability for me, but it was a challenge for them, which ultimately comes in any relationship.
Well, all of your stories bring up kind of the amount of learning and unlearning that we all need to do from kind of assumptions that we inherit and that we're kind of schooled in and cultured in, and both for able-bodied folks and for folks with various abilities. And I wonder, I don't have much time at all, but Julianne, if we could just close by, maybe if you could tell me, if you could kind of go back in time to your younger self, thinking about the narratives that we've talked about today and what you wish you knew back then, as you entered this dating and sex and relationship landscape, what would you tell your younger self in this moment?
I would tell my younger self as I was going to move through life, is to remember that every person is in a mortal body that is going to change over time, and that people are going to be reacting to in different ways based on their own issues and their own past and their own interpretations. And to be aware that because of that, there were going to be people that were going to love me fiercely and be so ready to be with me however I am. And there was people that wouldn't be, and there's always people that won't be. And right now, knowing that my husband very recently started having problems with his back as we're both approaching 40 and is dealing with also having a disabled body in some ways, and to remember that all of us that live long enough will know what it means to live through a disabled body, because that's so situational. And I would realize that the older I get, the more I move through life, the more at ease with my disabled body the people are around me, because they're aging and their bodies are breaking down too.
Thank you so much to all of you. I wish I had more time, but thank you so much. D.R.C. Charrington is an advocate and doctoral candidate in English at The Ohio State University. Ariella Barker is an attorney for the City of New York and former Miss Wheelchair North Carolina. And Julianne Scott Pollack, a scholar and professor at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. Thanks so much to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that is
thank
the state
you.
Of thank you so much. That is the state of things for today. You've been listening to the Embodied series. If you have enjoyed what you've heard, you can go check out the podcast wherever you get your podcast, thestateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.